relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
Welcome, dear friends, back to America First, but it's one-on-one. It is our opportunity to go a little bit deeper, to get to know our special guests, our regular contributors, people who we have great respect for and who deserve to be better known by millions of people across the nation and across the world. Somebody who I've relied upon for years, who I got to know through my good friend John Batchelor and his radio show, is as far as I'm concerned, sinologist number one. He is the China expert I refer to when I want to understand what is going on in Asia. His name is Gordon Chang. You can follow him at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back to this special one-on-one.
Thank you so much, Seb.
So I want to talk, I want to cross the waterfront, all the key issues, not just what's happened in the last 6 months, not just what's happened since China has a new self-anointed emperor, but I want to talk about the broader geopolitical aspects. You have a very robust Twitter account. You have been very outspoken in terms of the threat of communism writ large to Western civilization. But first, for those who haven't heard of you before, who are tuning in for the first time to this discussion or listening to it on a video platform, tell us a little bit of who Gordon Chang is and how you got the very robust beliefs that you have today.
Well, Seb, I'm a writer, and I wrote a book, The Coming Collapse of China, in 2001, in which I predicted the Communist Party would fail in 10 years. So I was wrong about that. The reason why I wrote that book was because Lydia and I were living in China. We moved there August 1996 because I went there to work for my primary client, Citibank. We were doing all sorts of deals, and it was a very optimistic time. And I can remember when we moved to Shanghai, Lydia got on the phone and said, "Mom, China's not communist anymore." And I agreed with her because I saw my clients, they would buzz into Shanghai. They would stay at the Grand Hyatt, which is one of the most spectacular hotels in the world, and they would say the same thing. But as we lived in China, as we traveled around, talked to people, worked there, we saw a very different country. And that led us to believe that the regime was not stable. I think it still is unstable. It was able to get through largely because of the 2008 downturn. And also because companies didn't hold China to its World Trade Organization promises, which I thought they would. So I've been wrong about timing. But we're seeing a China right now that is dangerous. Now, a lot of people say that it's dangerous because it's strong. I think it's dangerous because it's weak. But fundamentally, we have agreement on one point, and that is that China poses an existential threat to the United States and to the international system.
One thing, you know me, my proclivities, I'm a national security guy, I'm a big picture grand strategy guy, that's what excites me. And one of my mentors at a distance, somebody I admired greatly, who we lost far too early, is Colin Gray, a US-Brit national, dual national, who has written the books on grand strategy. If you're not familiar with his modern strategy, dear friends, read Colin Gray's modern strategy. And he developed this idea with some of his British colleagues, of strategic culture, meaning that every nation has a peculiar strategic culture, meaning how its people and especially how its decision-making elites look at the world, look at the concept of national security and defense, and it's different. Belgium has a different national security from Vanuatu or a different national security culture or way of looking at the world. Will you help us? Let's just start at the beginning. Let's build the building blocks of understanding the current environment. by understanding what is different about China. In my estimation, it hasn't really changed since the end of the Warring Kingdoms period, and it has been an empire in all but name, whether or not who was in charge. But help those who are not steeped in the culture of this nation or geopolitics to understand what's different from China and America or China and Belgium.
China is, in a sense, unique. And as you point out, all countries are unique. But China is unique in a way which is actually frightening. Because Xi Jinping, the current ruler, has views that are the same as those during two millennia of Chinese imperial rule, which ended in 1912. The problem is that Chinese leaders today, as they did during the imperial era, believe in Tianxia, or all under heaven. And that means that they believe that they are not only have the right to rule all under heaven, but they're also compelled by heaven to do so. You know, many people talk about the mandate of heaven, and that's all a part of this. So this has gotten to frightening proportions because Xi Jinping has extended this concept not only to all of planet Earth, but also to the near parts of the solar system, specifically the moon and Mars, which now Chinese officials are talking about should be considered part of the People's Republic. So we've got the most ambitious rulers in history now, and that is their culture. They believe that they have a right to rule. The United States, on the other hand, is powerful, but we don't believe that. We believe that everyone works well when everyone is prosperous. Got to remember that at the end of the Second World War, the United States was more powerful than any other nation in history, not only as an absolute matter, but also relative to everybody else. What the U.S. did was it tried to strengthen Europe, and we created competitors for ourselves with the Marshall Plan and with other things. So this was the United States saying, look, we need to make sure the world is prosperous and stable. We understand that this is going to undercut our relative power, but this is good for everybody. That, in essence, is the difference between American and Chinese strategic thinking.
Just to clarify, you know, for conservatives and for others, there is a sense that America has a manifest destiny, that it has a role to play as the nation with the oldest constitution, as the only nation that has a constitution based on the concept of individual liberty. But if these are both nations that have a sense of manifest destiny, the big difference is one wishes to impose its system, which is not based on liberty, on all others, and have all nations as satrapies or tributary nations. And America wishes to be the example to the rest of the world of how to create these systems. Is that a fair contrast?
Oh, absolutely. Because the United States believes that, you know, we go through the post-war era when you have the creation of all of these multilateral institutions, the UN, World Bank, International Monetary Fund. And the idea was to create this system of rules, conventions, treaties, norms, guidelines. And that's what the United States put in place. That's the system that survived the Cold War. Now, there are problems with that system, which have become deep and fundamental. But generally speaking, the United States has always said, look, we are all in this together. We're all going to prosper together, or none of us are really going to prosper on a sustainable basis. Whereas China says, look, we are the only ones who have a right to rule. And that is a fundamental divide, which really we cannot bridge. For as long as the Communist Party is there ruling China, this is something that we cannot reconcile with them about.
You said you traveled there, you lived there, you worked there in the 1990s. Many companies have invested millions, if not billions, into China, despite it being a one-party state. Could you clarify for us? Are those who are saying, oh, it's not communist, it's a new version of capitalism. What is the Chinese system today, Gordon Chang?
That's you got great timing, Seb, because Ray Dalio, the Wall Street legendary figure, actually said something like this just a few hours ago, saying, well, look, you know, China's communist rulers aren't communists. They are not anti-capitalists. And what he was referring to was, of course, over the last two, 3 weeks, starting with the initial public offering of DD Global on June 30, we have witnessed China attack its tech sector. And many people have said that this has been suicide because Xi Jinping has wiped hundreds of billions of dollars of value off of markets globally, maybe approaching about $1 trillion, and he's not stopped. But really, this is Xi Jinping believes he reveres Mao. Now, he is not able to make China today a Maoist state, but that's where he's driving things. And so Ray Dalio is absolutely wrong about that. Xi Jinping doesn't have the political power to, for instance, rule by dictate, but he is pushing China back to a state system, something that Mao Zedong would be familiar with. And as long as Xi is in power, that's the direction that China is going. A lot of people, and one other context, a lot of people call China authoritarian. Well, maybe one could make the argument that during the era of Deng Xiaoping and his successors, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, that maybe China was authoritarian. I don't buy it, but a lot of people, and that's the majority view. But today, I don't think we can say that with the Great Firewall, the social credit system, with all the other elements of the coercive state. China is now semi-totalitarian. And if Xi Jinping gets its way, it will go back to full-on totalitarianism. So really, that is the essence of Chinese rule today. It is a country in transition, moving in the wrong direction.
I love that, the description of semi-totalitarian. We're talking to Gordon Chang. Follow him at Gordon G. Chang. The latest book, monograph, is The Great U.S.-China Tech War. Relief Factor. Have you tried every other form of pain relief only to fail and not find your answer? Well, try this incredible product that is providing liberation from pain to tens of thousands of Americans across the country, including Alicia from California. I'm a grocery store worker and have been working doubles during this coronavirus shutdown. At 52 years old, my two bad knees are not getting a rest. I literally limp to and from bed. 2 days into Relief Factor and the pain has decreased substantially. So thankful for this amazing product. That could be you. It should be you. Find out today the only way you can by ordering the 3-week quick starter pack at relieffactor.com. Call them at 800-500-8384. It'll be at your door in 3 days or less. Take it morning and evening just like I do. And I promise you, by the end of those 3 weeks, you will know whether it works for you like it works for me, Alicia, and thousands of your fellow Americans. What have you got to lose except the pain? Do it today. 800-500-8384. ReliefFactor.com. ReliefFactor.com. Gordon, you mentioned Mao in your discussion of China today and the fact that Xi Jinping is creating a semi-authoritarian regime. He's not Mao. Help us to understand who Mao is and why for some... I mean, we talk about communism. My parents suffered under communism. Stalin, Lenin, these are the figures we think of. But the Chinese regime is the deadliest of all. We are talking about maybe 50, 60 million people killed in the name of Karl Marx's utopia. Talk to us about the significance of Mao in the building of the communist state and the significance of Mao still today.
Mao was one of the early members of the Chinese Communist Party, which was generally formed around 1921. The official birthday is July 1st, 1921. Mao was an enormous figure, dominated China and indeed dominated Asia for quite some time. When Mao was successful in forming the People's Republic of China, which was declared on October 1st, 1949, Mao became the most powerful Chinese leader, and eventually he pushed out others. And during Mao's era, the death toll was staggering, far beyond any other leader. People say, for instance, in the Great Leap Forward, which was the campaign 1959, 1960, 1961, the time of the Great Famine, as it's called, there's somewhere between 30 and 70 million people died. Now, in addition to that, you have 5 million people in the Cultural Revolution. You've got several million here and there. But Mao's death total could very well be somewhere in the 70, 75 million range. Other people put it less. But the point is that this was one man directly responsible for policies that resulted in the deaths of tens of millions of people. And this is, I believe, the person most has the biggest death toll in history. Mao was a charismatic figure. He was able to kill so many people because he intimidated everybody else. And because of that, Chinese communism has never been the same before. Xi Jinping admires Mao, talks about Mao, visits Mao places around China, historic locations. And he's driving China red, as they say. And that means that we've got to be concerned that we've got another Mao Zedong who is now currently ruling China.
With, you've described the incredible hotels, the businesses, the investment, what Shanghai looks like. Can you give us a glimpse into what the reality for Chinese nationals who aren't part of the Communist Party elite, just how communist a nation this still is, and what kind of persecution, not just Uyghurs, but ethnic Han Chinese suffer today?
Yes. Just to take a look at, for instance, the ordinary Chinese. There are 95 million people in the Communist Party of China, but only 300 or so really count. And the ones who are the most important sit on the Politburo Standing Committee, which is seven people. And of those seven, there is only one figure of significance these days, and that's Xi Jinping. Because Xi Jinping believes that he has to have absolute control over the Communist Party and that the Communist Party have absolute control over society. Most Chinese have a decent level of living, but nonetheless, they have certainly not as prosperous as they would have been if they had a democratic form of governance. And we know that because Japan, South Korea, Taiwan were as poor as China was in the late 1940s. And those societies are so much better. And by the way, in those societies, you don't have the death toll that we, of course, have just been talking about. But the problem in China right now is not so much prosperity, but it's people chafing under this dictatorial system. And that means, for instance, if you're a Christian, even if you don't have any sort of revolutionary tendencies, I mean, Christians don't, they just want to pray. But China has made them enemies of the state. Same with Tibetans, same with Uyghurs. China has created these enemies by forcing them into complete subservience and obedience. And of course, if you're a Turkic minority, if you're a Uyghur, a Kazakh, or one of the others, life is hell on earth, because what we have witnessed since 2017, when these policies were first put into place in Xinjiang, which is the northwest part of the country, has been people been detained in concentration camps. We know people are dying in those camps, Seb, because the regime is building crematoria next to them. There is brutality. There is institutionalized rape. There is forced organ harvesting from all that we can determine. And there's a policy of genocide. You put all this together, these are the most horrific policies since World War II. They're comparable to what the Third Reich did prior to the mass exterminations of 1941. And we've got to be concerned that China will actually make that next step because the policies are horrific.
Yeah, and American businesses are in part profiting from them, like Nike and others. We're talking to Gordon Chang, author of The Great U.S.-China Tech War. Follow him, Gordon G. Chang, on Twitter. Gordon, talk to us about Hong Kong, which was a paradise of freedom in the region and a financial center for Asia. It's kind of fallen off the radar, or the legacy media is not interested. What is the state or the plight of people living in Hong Kong now under communist Chinese control?
Hong Kong, which was once a relatively free and open city, has become, it's moving very fast to a totalitarian system. In 1984, Britain promised to return Hong Kong to China, as it was said. It was to be handed back on July 1st, 1997. And from then on, for 50 years, it was going to be a one country, two systems formula, where although Hong Kong was formally part of the People's Republic, it would be separate. The only thing that Hong Kong wouldn't do would be to be responsible for its own defense. That was part of Beijing's responsibility. So what Beijing has done is it's abrogated the Sino-British Joint Declaration, this 1984 treaty with Britain, and it has taken full control of Hong Kong. This became evident June 30 of last year when China imposed...
Oh, we're losing him again. China imposed what? Gun?
National security law on Hong Kong. And that has been, as people have said, the end of law in Hong Kong, because it's given China the ability and the right under that law to do anything that it wants. What we have seen in the last couple of days is, for instance, the arrest of singer Tony Wong. And he was arrested because in 2018 he gave a speech at a political rally for a candidate who won. Beijing didn't like it, so he's been arrested under an election law. But we have also witnessed about 100 people in Hong Kong arrested under the national security law. And in addition to that, China's closed Apple Daily, which was not only Hong Kong's main pro-democracy newspaper, it was Hong Kong's main newspaper. So this has been a total assault on civil society in Hong Kong, and it is on the way back to being just another Chinese city, as the phrase is used in that territory.
Let's go a little bit broader with our discussion. We're talking to Gordon Chang. It might be a cliche when you say you are what you eat, but it is absolutely true. Eating the right food ensures your body gets the nutrients it needs to maintain your health. And that includes, whether you like it or not, guys, I'm sorry, fruits and vegetables. If you're not a big fan, and most of us guys aren't, you still need to eat them. Do what I do. Dr. Douglas Howard's Balance of Nature is a game changer. Just vegetables, just fruit, freeze-dried into six little capsules. Three red for fruit, three green for vegetables that provide you 10 servings of 31 different fruits and vegetables your body needs and craves. Be the healthiest you can be. Dr. Howard's going to give you 35% off and free shipping on your first preferred order if you use my name. If you're worried about your health, just do this for your wife, for your mother, for your children, for your grandchildren. 800-246-8751, balanceofnature.com, promo code Gorka. Gordon, let me ask a tough question for you to answer. Do the Chinese want democracy? Is the culture with the Confucian background, with the emphasis of the collective over the individual, is this even possible to countenance in this part of the world?
I think that it is, because we see in Taiwan, which is not a Chinese society, but is closely related to China, where you have a vibrant, very, very prosperous society, very open, very democratic. And by the way, Seb, they run elections far better in Taiwan than we do, which is...
Do they have voter ID, story. Gordon? Do they have voter ID?
They not only have voter ID, they have a system, Seb, where it's paper ballots. What happens is when they count these ballots, everybody is in the room. And the government official responsible for the ballots actually holds it up to everybody. Everybody then counts it because they can all see it. And the process might take a little bit longer than ours, but it is virtually fraud proof. But put that aside for a moment. People in Taiwan are passionate about their democracy. They don't consider themselves Chinese. They consider themselves Taiwanese. But for many people, they look Chinese. They speak a language which is very similar to Mandarin. And they've got the same, or at least they had the same characters until Mao went to simplified characters. But the point is, yes, the Chinese people, they want, they're just like the rest of us. They want what everyone else has. On the mainland, it's a complicated question, and we don't really know the answer because you can't do a survey of something sensitive like that.
Yeah.
If you want to know what the Chinese people have a preference for toothpaste, you can do a survey. It will be reliable. If you're going to ask them, though, on something that the Communist Party feels it has an interest, such as, for instance, do you want more say in your life? You can't do that. You're right that there is a Confucian culture there. You're right that that is, in many respects, anti-democratic. But we also know that the Chinese people do want more of a say in their lives. And so, you know, at the particular time, even though Communist Party propaganda has been extremely effective in molding views, this is like the Truman Show. I mean, this is the only thing that people know. Nonetheless, we do know that there is discontent with the government style of the Communist Party. And if they've really had a choice, who knows what they would eventually choose.
Is there an underground in China? I know the Falun Gong have been targeted, but that is a quasi-religious movement. Is there a dissident movement in China, Gordon Chang?
Well, there is, Seb, and it's called the Underground Protestant Church. They're house churches. And as I said before, Catholics, Protestants, Buddhists, they don't want to be enemies of the state, but the state has turned them into one. And so if there is a dissident movement, I think that you would probably say that it is the Protestants who worship outside of the official Protestant church. In terms of democracy advocates, which is probably what you were going at, there are people who speak up. There are people who end up in jail and worse, like Liu Xiaobo, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. It is not a strong movement inside of China because the Communist Party has been obsessively thorough in attacking opponents of the party. But nonetheless, it's there. And it pops up at all sorts of times. And we've seen this with, for instance, in these insurgent groups, which sometimes have an effect. Sometimes they are then pushed back into the shadows, but they are generally there. They're not a major factor, but they do exist.
I have to play right now a clip that we've played several times on our radio show, and it's a perfect apropos for you to explain what's happened in the last 6 months with regards to U.S.-China relations. This is from the Anchorage summit with China, with the Biden administration. Cut three, play cut.
So let me say here that in front of the Chinese side, the United States does not have the qualification to say that it wants to speak to China from a position of strength.
Gordon, would that have happened from the chief diplomat at that meeting under the Trump administration? And if not, what does it bode for the future? What does it mean about U.S.-China relations since Biden was inaugurated?
Well, in fact, during the Trump administration, senior Chinese officials never said anything like that in public. And I don't think that they actually were ever inclined to think that they might be able to do that.
Why? Seb, why? What did they think of us under the Trump administration?
Chinese officials were scared of Trump, which is basically, you know, Chinese officials, they can deal with a tough American president. They can deal with a weak one. What they can't deal with is an unpredictable one. And from their perspective, Trump was unpredictable. His policies, in their view, were not certain. And so they always gave the U.S. a wide berth. And I think part of this is really stems from that meeting in 2017, April or so, when Xi Jinping went to Mar-a-Lago, spent a couple days with Trump. Trump, like all new American presidents, was trying to establish some sort of relationship with the Chinese. But what Trump did was different than previous American presidents. And it was, I think, epitomized by that dinner that they had over that wonderful chocolate cake, as people talk about. And that was that Trump announced the airstrikes on Syria, a China friend. And this, I think, deeply shook Xi Jinping.
Over the chocolate cake. I mean, this is important that my former boss said, by the way, we've launched 53 cruise missiles on Syria chemical weapons bases as he's eating his chocolate cake. There's a certain, that's not just a message for Xi Jinping, that's a message for all client states and all dictatorships. Is it not, Gordon?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that set the tone for the rest of the Trump administration with regard to China. We know, Seb, of elite Chinese attitudes towards Biden. And that's just we don't have to guess about this. On November 28th of last year, Di Dongcheng, a prominent Chinese academic at Renmin University in Beijing, actually had that big event where he was talking, and this was broadcast around China, where he was talking about how in administrations previous to Trump, that China could determine outcomes at the highest levels of the U.S. because they were able to use Henry Kissinger, he referred to, and they were able to use Wall Street. And Professor Di actually said, during the Trump administration, we couldn't do this anymore because that connection was broken, which was the way that he put it.
Their buddies at Wall Street wouldn't help them out.
Right. Well, couldn't help them out because Trump had just not listening.
Yeah.
Of course, Wall Street wanted to influence the Trump administration, worked very hard to do so, but were not able to because Trump was his own president. And Professor Di then said, remember, this was after the election. He said, with the Biden team coming in, we're looking forward to reestablishing that Wall Street connection with the White House. Now, Di expressed an arrogance, because if you got to listen to the words and everything, that was frightening. And that arrogance carried through in the clip that you just played, which was Zhang Jiaxue, China's number one diplomat.
Yeah.
And that's really chilling, because what he was saying, what Yang was actually saying to the United States was, look, deterrence is breaking down. We Chinese can do what we want. You can't stop us. And because of China's ambitions, we know that this is one of the most dangerous things that the Chinese could have said.
You have to read this man's book, The Great U.S.-China Tech War. You have to follow him on Twitter, GordonChang.com. But for the purpose of this interview, for this discussion, explain to us the significance of the 100th anniversary of the Communist Revolution in 2049 and the concept of One Belt, One Road, and how all these things tie together, Gordon.
On July 1st of this year, the Communist Party marked the centennial of its founding. 2049 will be the centennial of the establishment of the People's Republic. And between now and then, there are certain dates that do have some significance for the Communist Party. But let's just take a look at what Xi Jinping said on July 1st. He is widely quoted as saying that we will crack skulls and spill blood for those who stand in our way. But there was something even worse that he said, which I thought was more ominous. And he said, quote, the Communist Party of China and the Chinese people, with their bravery and tenacity, solemnly proclaim that the Chinese people are not only good at taking down the old world, but also in building a new one. Really, what Xi Jinping was saying was that they were going to take down the existing Westphalian international system, which recognizes the sovereignty of states, and they were going to replace it with what we were talking about before, this notion that Chinese rulers had the mandate of heaven over Tianxia. And by the way, Seb, for people who are interested, don't read the official Chinese translation of Xi Jinping's words, because it's actually quite benign in a number of spots. You have to read a literal English translation of the Chinese, because really what that does is it shows the maliciousness of the Chinese system. We're dealing with a malicious ruler, dangerous, arrogant, bellicose, who wants to go out and kill people. And indeed, Xi Jinping has his own death toll, which is now somewhere in the neighborhood of about 4.5 million.
So just as with the Palestinian Authority, do not read the English language version of their statements. You have to read the original Arabic because they are very, very different. Let's go a little bit deeper into the One Belt, One Road. For me, this plan divides the world from the point of view of Beijing into enemies to be subdued and then client states or satrapies or tributary nations nations that will be simply vassals. Is that an oversimplification? How does One Belt, One Road work? What is the global vision for China as it looks at the world coming up to the 100th anniversary of the Communist Revolution?
Yeah. The Belt and Road Initiative, as it's now called, is really started out as two initiatives. There was a belt, and these were announced at in September 2013. There was a belt, which was to connect the east coast of China to Europe, and there was a road, which was a water route connecting both locations, east coast of China and Europe. Since then, Belt and Road has been extended around the world, and they've added the Digital Silk Road, which started out life in 2015 or so as a separate plan, but was incorporated into Belt and Road. So Belt and Road is really an attempt to build the infrastructure to tie the world to China. Now, this gets a little bit complicated. I've never really been too worried about Belt and Road, largely because, I practice law in Hong Kong. I didn't do infrastructure work, but my firm did. And I can tell you that all of the economically justifiable projects in the world were being handled by the private sector. What China's doing is building the infrastructure that nobody else wanted to.
Yeah, and subsidizing it below market rates.
Yes. There is a danger, though, and that is we have seen what's called debt trap diplomacy, because these projects are not economically justifiable for the most part. But what China has been able to do was to use its position as a creditor to take over control of facilities. So, for instance, it took control of Hanban Toda, which is a port in Sri Lanka. We know that China has used its Colombo International Container Terminal, also in Sri Lanka, for military purposes. Djibouti, China's really only offshore military installation, is in a country that has a debt to China that is probably in excess of 100% of its gross domestic product. So that's no coincidence. But the reason why I get really worried about Belt and Road is because of the Bahamas.
Yes.
In the Bahamas, a Hong Kong firm is pouring something like $3 billion, maybe a little bit more, into the Freeport Container Port. It's also, there's a Chinese investment in the Bahamas in Abaco Islands. The Abaco port is completely without economic justification. The Freeport one, which is in construction, probably isn't going to work because it's far too big and misconceived from the beginning. And I'm worried that we could end up with two Chinese naval bases in the Bahamas, one of them 87 miles from Palm Beach. That's why we've got to be concerned about Belt and Road. Even though this is a plan which is misconceived, it has geopolitical benefits which pose a military threat to the United States. And that threat is direct and it's near.
Let me share a story with you. I was invited to give a speech on life at Kay in the Bahamas. And on the drive from the airport to this very shishi resort where Sean Connery used to live, we drove past this wire fence for miles, this 12-foot-high fence. And I asked the person escorting us, what is that? And he said, oh, that's the new resort and casino complex being built by the Chinese government. And I said, okay, why has he got a 12-foot fence around it? Said, well, because nobody from here is allowed to work there, and they ship in 4,000 Chinese workers to build this facility. This is on a little island in the Bahamas, Gordon.
Yes, and that's why we've got to be concerned. You know, you look around the Caribbean, Jamaica has become a Chinese colony in a sense. Cuba, in the news recently, that's dotted with a number of Chinese installations. And China is one of the two main backers to Cuba, the other being Venezuela. But Venezuela has one main backer, and that's China. And in Cuba is Lourdes, which during the Cold War was the Soviet Union's biggest listening post outside of the Soviet Union. Well, now it's China's. And so they're listening to every phone call, every Zoom call, every call whatsoever in the United States from 50 miles west of Havana.
Two last questions. Talking to Gordon Chang, please follow him on Twitter, Gordon G. Chang, and get his books, especially The Great U.S. China Tech War. Number one, I love your Twitter feed. You have found your wings on your Twitter feed in recent weeks, Gordon. And I'm just going to read out two tweets to demonstrate the passion with which you tackle these issues. This was just before we went on air. Fight for your freedom. Fight for your family. Fight for your country. Fight China's regime. Next one. China's communists are coming for all peoples, especially those who insist on living in freedom. We will resist. Hashtag 1776 spirit. Thank you, Gordon. Tell us where that passion comes from.
My dad grew up not far from Shanghai, across the river, across the Yangtze River. And he was a refugee from communism. He was fortunate to get a U.S. get a scholarship to Cornell. He flew. This was during the war. With everybody else, he was in Shanghai. He was driven west by the Japanese. You know, tens of millions of Chinese were pushed across the country. He got the Chinese scholarship, from Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government. Flew over the hump, the Himalayas. Then took a Liberty ship down to Australia and from Australia to Los Angeles. And the reason for the detour was to avoid Japanese submarines.
Wow.
And he landed in the U.S. He landed in the U.S. in February 1945, just before the end of the war. And he always told me about what life was like. He fortunately was not there during communist rule because he escaped it. But if anything, you know, if that's anywhere it comes from that. And my wife, Lydia, grew up in Hong Kong. And she, you know, she obviously a different experience, but she has taught me what it is to be an American because she didn't grow up. She grew up in a colony, Seb. And you don't really know freedom until you don't have it.
You and your wife are champions. All Americans, immigrants or not, refugees or not, owe you a debt of gratitude. Please never stop doing what you do, Gordon. I have one last question to you, and I apologize for my naivete as the child of those, of a father who till his dying day bore the scars of communist secret police torture on his body, physically the scars. Why are we doing any business with China? I mean, why is one American business doing business with China? Is it impossible? Are we so intertwined that we allow this moral bankruptcy to continue in a nation that has political prisoners, that provide thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of stories like your father's? Can't we cut the cord? This is slave labor camps, the forced organ harvesting. Is it too much to ask? Am I naive, Gordon?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that, Seb. You know, part of it was the hubris after the Cold War. I mean, and we Americans are generous. We believe that if we integrated China and other regimes into the international system, they would become benign. Now, obviously, that didn't happen. And what's happened since then is that there are elements in U.S. society. There's Wall Street, there's Walmart, others that have a stake in the success of the Communist Party. So that has, and they're very powerful elements in our society. And that's why we Americans have got to take our country back. And this is existential because China tries to overthrow our government. And actually, last year, it incited violence to do so. I think that we're going to have this struggle with Americans who support Beijing until, and this is what I'm afraid of, until an American service person dies. And then everything will change. And we will cut those business and investment and education links. But by then, it'll be too late.
This is a much, much longer conversation. In the meantime, Gordon, Lydia, God bless you for doing what you do. We shall continue this conversation. Follow this man at Gordon G. Chang. Read his books. I'm Sebastian Gorka, and you've been listening and watching One on One.